Well, it's a pleasure to be here, everybody. My talk today is going to focus on the big picture of the election, but I want to start by making a few horse race related comments. The first is that I'm often, usually called upon by anxious conservatives, with please calm me down, which is very ironic, because if anybody knows me personally, my wife will attest to this, that I am the most nervous person. Usually people who know me personally, I'm the most nervous person they know. And I can assure you that as nervous as any of you are about this election, I am substantially more so. It is just part of who I am, and it's actually why over the years I've acquired as many facts and data and historical analogies as I have. It's because the data I find calms me down, but it doesn't solve the problem. So if you are up late some night in October, you can't sleep because you're worried about the election, I guarantee you, you are not alone. First of all, the second point I want to make is, and this is sort of a broad point, and it's a broad sweeping generalization, but political analysis in this country, as done by the popular press, the pundits, the analysts, is almost exclusively misguided. Very, very few exceptions. I read very little by way of popular commentary because I view most of it wrong on the fundamentals. And why do I say that? Well, I say that because most of it is ultimately based on the political polling. Political polling has become a crutch in the last 50 years for solid analysis of the fundamentals. You know, it's amazing to imagine that, 80 years ago, when Franklin Roosevelt was running for election, he didn't have polls. In fact, he had the Literary Digest poll that showed he was going to lose. He was going to lose in a landslide. But now we have polls, and we're inundated with polls. You can't get away from the polls. And the polls have a fundamental epistemological fallacy to them. What is a poll? A poll is a sample of a population, right? So if I was going to poll adults, or if I was going to do a poll of college students at Amherst, I'd pick, however many students at random, and then I have a margin of error. Well, what's the problem with that with elections? It's a sample of a population that doesn't exist yet. Nobody knows who's going to vote on election day. Sure, there's some guidelines to who's going to vote, and we have some rough ideas. But nobody really knows. And it's been compounded. This problem with polling has been compounded. It's actually gotten worse, if you can believe it, because it's been bad for a generation. But it's gotten worse in the sense now that there's polls that come out every day, 30 polls, 50 polls, and then you have polling aggregators like Nate Silver who are going to take the polls, put them into some kind of black box methodology that nobody understands. I don't even think he understands. And comes out with a result and tells you with 95% confidence that Barack Obama is going to win. Oh, okay, fine. Well, let's look at some history of political polls. In fact, there's only one poll right now that you can look at through the course of history, because, of course, pollsters have come and go. And, you can say the CBS News New York Times poll has Obama up this much, but what's it really mean? Because we don't know what that poll would have said in, say, 1980. There's one poll that we know what it said in 1980, we know what it said in 72, so on and so forth. That's a Gallup poll right now of registered voters. And I sort of excused myself during lunch to pull this data up. So right now the Gallup poll of registered voters is showing Barack Obama up 6 points over Mitt Romney. That's not a great number, right? Okay. Well, in 2004, at this point, the same poll was showing Bush up 11 over John Kerry. In 2000, at this point, the poll was showing Al Gore up 6 over George W. Bush. In 1996, that poll was showing Bill Clinton up amazing 24 points over Bob Dole. That ended up being a 9-point race. How about 1980? In early October, it showed Jimmy Carter up 4 and Ronald Reagan stuck at 40%. 1976 showed Gerald Ford down 11. That ended up being a 2-point race. And of course, 1968, Hubert Humphrey was getting the floor wiped with him. He was down 15 points and stuck at 29% of the vote. That one ended up being settled by less than half a point. So what's the lesson? The lesson is polls in September are extremely problematic. And the problem is not, in fact, solved by multiplying the number of polls. And it's not solved by aggregating the polls through some black box methodology. And the reason why polls are... And that, in fact, makes the polling worse. And the reason why is if you look at voter decision-making, voters, 25% of voters made their final decision in 2008. They made it in October or early November. In 2004, it was 21%. In 2000, it was 30%. Nearly one out of three voters made their final decision in October. Same in 1996. And that's the fundamental problem with the polls, is that they give you a false impression of the race, because it doesn't take into account the level of uncertainty in voter decision-making. And so the polls have to be read with an extreme degree of skepticism. But the problem now is that the polls are unavoidable. So what I want to do in my talk today is sort of move beyond the polls. And I want to talk about the big picture, where we are in American politics right now, and where that leaves the two candidates, and then sort of give some purchase on what to expect in terms of the horse race. And the basic thesis of my argument is that American politics is really stuck in a rut. And it's a rut much like the rut that was experienced in the 1880s and 1890s, and also the mid-1960s through the early 1980s. And the rut that we're in is going to constrain, and it has constrained, the ability of our political class to solve the major problems we face. And moreover, both sides really, in my opinion, lack solid, actionable ideas to solve our problems. The corollary to the 1880s and 1890s was there was a rapid expansion, overexpansion into the West. There was the concentration of wealth in the form of the trusts. There was rapid urbanization that created all sorts of problems in terms of, you know, keeping cities safe and clean and so on and so forth. And what were the Democrats and the Republicans arguing over? Well, pretty much Catholicism and the tariff. And they didn't have any good ideas. And similarly, in the 1960s and 70s, you had issues of inflation, you had Vietnam, you had race riots and crime. Neither side had a good strategy on how to deal with them. So that's sort of my broad context here. And I want to start with, you know, 4 points really bring the current situation into focus in terms of the broad context. The first is the intensive partisanship of the present age. We've seen periods of American politics where one side dominates the other. The 1820s through the 1850s had the Democrats dominating the Whigs. The 1890s through the 1920s had the Republicans dominate the Democrats. And the 1930s through the 1950s, more or less, the Democrats dominated the Republicans. But really, since about 1968, we can quibble over the dates, but about since 1968, we've had, roughly speaking, a level of political parity. Since Nixon was elected, we've had 32 years of divided government and only 12 years of unified government. And all of the eras of unified government ended in party waves. In 1980, in 1994, in 2006, the party that had had total control of the government was basically ridden out on a rail. Moreover, in terms of the electorate, since about 1988, we've seen the two sides have been roughly locked in with a base of 45 to 47% of the vote. So in other words, if this were a football game, you know, for the last 40 years, it's been a game fought between the 45-yard lines. Now, the Democratic Party counts as its base, the white socioeconomic upscale liberals, urbanites, racial and ethnic minorities, and young people. The Republican Party basically has the white married middle class, which includes small town denizens, suburbanites, churchgoers, non-union members, and of course, rural people who used to be strongly Democratic but have become strongly Republican. So the battle for the presidential race is waged over a shockingly small percentage of the country. And just to put this in context, this is the map of the 2000 presidential election, and we can see the basic contours of the division here. You can see the Democrats control the Northeast, basically, and the red is Democrats in this. And by the way, it's a very unfortunate thing for people like myself who do history, because all through history, Republicans were coded in blue and Democrats in red. But then CBS News in 2000 decided arbitrarily to switch it. So you're going to have to forgive the color. The president maps, in my opinion, are wrong. I consider the Republicans the party of blue and the Democrats are the reds. So anyway, you can see here, the California coast and up through in Seattle, and the Democrats have, of course, the I-95 corridor is basically theirs. The Republicans control the farmland in the middle. And then what you see basically is American politics comes down to a battle around the suburbs around places like Columbus and Cincinnati and Milwaukee and so on and so forth. And what's amazing is that map from 2000 is going to essentially be the map in 2012. And this is despite the fact that we've had two wars, a terrorist attack, and an economic collapse. So that's sort of the first point. The second broad point is that satisfaction with the federal government is at or near all-time lows. And as you can see from this chart, which I pulled from the National Election Study, this is the percent of Americans who trust the government, quote, most of the time. In the 1950s and early 60s, Americans had a great deal of trust in the government, and you can appreciate it for good reasons. I mean, after all, what had the government done? By 1952, think about what the government had done over the last 20 years. Well, and the impression, of course, I think that the facts are very different, but the impression was that the New Deal had solved the problem of the Great Depression. In World War II, there was a defeat of the Germans and the Japanese, a two-ocean war, the likes of which had never been seen before. The Soviet expansion had basically been stopped. I mean, Korea was not a successful military exercise in the sense of, you know, beating back the communists, but nevertheless kept them from taking over the entire peninsula. And we were on the cusp of what turned out to be the greatest economic boom the world had ever seen. But the tide begins to turn in the mid-1960s. And what we see are, you know, Vietnam. Crime is out of control. Federal government seems to have no response to the crime issue. The Kerner Commission just says pour more money into the cities, even though we're running out of money. The credibility gap, of course, is a famous synonym for the Johnson administration. And then we have Nixon with Watergate and Ford with inflation. Carter has inflation as well in the Iran hostage crisis. You can see things improve a little bit during the mid-1980s. But then the early era of the Clinton administration, people are very dissatisfied. Of course, it's followed up by Lewinsky Gate. And then most recently, we have had the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, which were very unpopular. At least they are today. And, of course, the economic collapse. So today, there's a widespread belief among both political parties that the government is not capable of solving the country's biggest challenges, and more dangerously for the status of our republic, that the government doesn't represent them, that the government instead represents special interests, business interests, left-wing and right-wing interest groups, and similarly represents the most extreme voices in the political process. Third broad point is that the American economy is in a secular decline. And by secular, I mean slow moving. And this goes beyond the concept of the business cycle, right? The boom and bust, which has basically been with us since the 1830s. Any industrialized economy is going to have a boom and bust. But what we've seen over the last decade or more is that the booms have been weaker and weaker and weaker. And this graph tracks that by, this is the annual percentage change in GDP per capita per year. So you can see here, the recoveries in the 1960s after recession, the recession from the mid-1970s, and the recession from the mid-1980s were all very robust. But the recovery from the recession in the early 1990s was very weak. The recovery from the recession at the start of the Bush administration was even weaker. Now, historically speaking, weak recessions like that tend to produce relatively weak recoveries. But nevertheless, during, you can see here, this was a very deep recession, the deepest we've had, and yet the recovery has been weakest. Right. So basically from the 50 years from Eisenhower's election in 1952 and George W. Bush's election in 2000, economic growth averaged about 3.5% per year. Ever since then, it's averaged about 1.5%. So what we are seeing is an economic slowdown that is similarly threatening the very foundation of our republic, of course, because a republican form of government envisions a government of equals, of political equals at the least, not necessarily economic equals, but political equals. But one of the consequences of this slowdown is that there is a growing inequality between income groups, and it's also related to growing status inequality. A lot of this has to do with the precipitous decline of the industrial sector, which really dropped off a cliff after the 2000 recession, even though it was relatively mild. It never really recovered. That's an important development because it was the industrialization of the economy, particularly after World War II, that enabled the second wave immigrant groups, Italians, the Poles, the Jews, and other Southern and Eastern European groups to enter into the middle class. And they could get good paying jobs but working in the industrial sector. And this, by the way, is a big reason why the working class was, you know, the most sympathetic to communism, most sympathetic to Eugene Debs in the 19-teens. But by 1968 was voting for Richard Nixon. By 1980 was voting for Ronald Reagan. In other words, the great American growth machine had transformed them into middle class voters. But we're seeing a major challenge right now, and the challenge is a decline in manufacturing employment, which you can appreciate in this graph here. You can see how low we are here. We have about 12 million in industrial jobs, and you'll notice economists will often celebrate how, industry is leading the recovery. I mean, it's sort of this sick joke because, in fact, we are in, if you wanted to really make an argument, you could argue that we are in a 30-year recession when it comes to industrial jobs. We hit our peak in the late 1970s. And what we're seeing instead are growth in jobs in two directions. The first is white-collar jobs, right? So these are the jobs that sort of give you a purchase into the middle class. And this is just one example of something that I put together. This is one of many different examples of white collar jobs, financial service jobs. And as you can see, the recession, this was really kind of a recession proof industry up through the collapse in 2007, 2008, but the collapse wasn't that deep and it's already growing again. This is the sort of stuff where, these are the jobs where you make enough money to have a comfortable middle class existence. But the problem, though, is that, like I said, the blue-collar jobs are disappearing. Gray-collar jobs are on the rise as well. And these are also recession-proof, okay, the retail service workforce. But people in these sorts of jobs tend to struggle to make ends meet. And moreover, it's extremely difficult to enjoy a middle-class life in a retail service industry because you have to work odd hours, you have to work split shifts. You have difficult, in terms of seeing your children off to school and being at home when they're at home to make sure they're not playing Xbox and they're actually studying and all sorts of things. These are not good jobs for that. And also these jobs don't pay good benefits and these people tend to just are barely making ends meet. So that leads me to my fourth broad point. This sort of idea of this gray collar, the growth of the gray collar economy, which is really not enough to generate prosperity, is that the government is increasingly making up the difference for these people. Okay, so this is the percentage of income that the average American derives from government income support. So this is Social Security. This is also in-kind stuff like food stamps and Medicare. And as you can see, in the early 1960s, it was about 5%. Today, it peaked around 18%, but today it's still at a whopping 17.5%. And when the two political parties talk about the deficit, they almost never talk about this. The real driver of our deficit is the fact that about 20 cents on every dollar in the average American's wallet is coming from the government. That is what is driving our deficit right now. The government is keeping standards of living afloat as the American economy is increasingly unable to provide that kind of prosperity, right? And there's a problem here as well, because the big driver in all of this is Medicare. And the problem with Medicare is that Medicare is not a promise that we'll give you X amount of money. Medicare is a promise that we will pay for X number of services. But as the cost of those services increase, so too will this graph here. This number is only going to go up. And you can appreciate that in the next chart, which is a sort of a two-line. The solid line is the nonsense report of Obamacare, right? This is Obamacare says, oh, we are going to cap Medicare spending as a percentage of GDP growth at 6%. What that is going to do is create massive cuts in services, and they know it. And this is one of those things that they'll let future generations deal with it. It's completely unsustainable. And this is actually from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is sort of the official government entity that's in charge of tracking Medicare. They see a more reasonable, politically reasonable, because, of course, what happens here when you get to, say, this point here and you see massive cuts in services, which is what's going to happen, the AARP is going to spring into action, and we're going to see exactly what we see every year with the doc fix. I mean, if everybody's heard of the doc fix. Doc fix is basically this patch in the mid-1990s. The Republicans cut Medicare and cut it by what they call the sustainable growth rate. But the AMA says we can't exist with that, so every year they have to patch it. So if we, by the time we get to this point, they're going to start patching it. And you can see, by the time I'm a senior citizen, it's going to be close to 9% of GDP, as opposed to less than 3% right now. And we're talking about an $8 trillion economy here. So the size, in fact, the size of the government is set to roughly double over the next two generations entirely because of Medicare. So, and that leads me to sort of a conclusion here. It is very gloomy, right? American people right now are extremely frustrated, and they feel disconnected from their government. They feel that their government doesn't reflect their interests, and I think they're right to think that. We're in the midst of an economic downturn that nobody seems to have any answers for, neither party. I mean, you know, you listen to the two political parties, and they talk about the same old things. The Republicans talk about tax cuts as if this is the 1980s or the 1970s, but it's not. Taxes are low. By and large, taxes are very low. You know, I mean, it's one thing in the 1970s when you have bracket creep because of inflation. Sure, a massive across-the-board tax cut's going to do a lot of good, but that's already, you know, half of the country has been moved off of the tax rolls now. So there's, you know, relatively, at least the income tax rolls, have been moved off. So, you know, the Democrats, and the Democrats... basic argument is to call you a bigot for pointing this out. I mean, if I had to summarize the Democratic position, would be when you point this out, you're a Republican radical bigot racist who is a global warming denier and you're homophobic. I mean, they don't even want to acknowledge this, in other words. And anybody who mentions it just gets invective thrown at them, right? So... this sets up the context for 2012, because so much of this was already happening in 2008, and implicitly Barack Obama was elected to change this, or at least to begin the process of changing this, right? And that was the whole point of, you know, hope and change, right? I mean, the two concepts, right? Things are bad, but we should have hope, and I will bring about change. In other words, all these things that are happening, I'm gonna turn them around, or at least I'm gonna start to. But in so many respects, in most respects, I would say, this president has made the situation worse. And 3 points deserve special mention. The first is the stimulus passed in 2009. And when we factor in the interest on the borrowed money, it cost more than $1 trillion. The problem with that was that it was terribly spent. I mean, even if you're a left-wing Keynesian stimulus advocate like Leon Kaiserling or John Kenneth Galbraith, you know, you're not, you know, the idea of good left-wing stimulus is not to pump money into special interest groups that vote for you and donate money, but that's exactly what they did. And Obama led congressional Democrats, which are frankly an indolent and in many cases corrupt group of legislators. One of the most corrupt caucuses, I think, in the last 50 years is today's crop of congressional Democrats, the backbenchers that nobody ever sees on television. He let them write that bill. And they larded that bill up with garbage to reward their core supporters, and the proof is in the pudding. I mean, this was the chart that Jared Bernstein and Christina Romer put out in January 2009 and said, if we pass the stimulus, this is going to be the path to recovery. If we don't pass it, this is where it's going to be. And the dotted lines actually track their unemployment rate. But when you factor in the decline in labor force participation and you begin to correct for that, you see the real unemployment rate's all the way up here. In fact, it's off the chart. It's at 11.2%. And we borrowed $1 trillion to get this result. It was a total waste. And the second way that this president exacerbated our problems is the health care bill, which was a highly ideological piece of legislation. And not just the content of it, but the timing of it. Because, of course, when the president was passing that bill, remember, unemployment, we were about right here when they were passing the bill, right? Unemployment had already moved beyond what they said it would, and rather than stop what they were doing and take a second look at how to jumpstart the economy, they doubled down. And it essentially for them, it was an ideological project. And it was a testament, you know, to the fact that on that chart of the 2000 election, if you look who dominates the Democratic Party, you know, the I-95 and I-5 corridors on the East and West Coast, that's what they wanted to do, and that's who the Democratic Party's responsive to. So, you know, that's why they pursued health care. And unfortunately, you know, the bill is known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, but does not protect patients and does not control costs. Instead, it's going to layer new burdens and regulations on businesses, and it's going to make it even harder to turn around the economy because, let's be honest, our only hope is private enterprise and reinvigorating private enterprise. The American people know this, so unsurprisingly, the bill has been massively unpopular. It enjoyed a slight uptick in popularity recently, but you can see it's a pretty stable majority's been opposed to it. The third issue is that the deficit has ballooned to basically comic sizes. I mean, this is approaching, you know, a Looney Tunes cartoon of what a deficit would be like. Now, in fairness to the president, some of this is not his fault. It has more to do, it has a lot to do with a collapse in tax revenues from the, you know, when you have a progressive tax code such as we do and the economy collapses, then people not only are going to pay less taxes, but they're going to fall into lower brackets. So you're going to collect less revenue while simultaneously all sorts of automatic stabilizers like food stamps, and there was political pressure for unemployment extensions ad infinitum. These sorts of things are not his fault per se, but the reality is that if you look very carefully at his budget, you'll see that his deficit plan is to just close his eyes and wish really hard that it disappears. I mean, he has no solution whatsoever for it. So you take all of this with the worst economic recovery in generations, and it shouldn't be a surprise that President Obama's job approval is very weak. And in fact, during the course of his presidency, his job approval has averaged about 47% in the Gallup poll through his entire term to date, and nobody has won re-election with historically such a weak job approval. So, slam dunk for the Republicans, right? Well, not really, for several reasons. First one is that the Republicans, unfortunately, take a lot of blame for the last decade. They're often assigned more blame than they're due. You know, when people blame George W. Bush for the recession, they conveniently forget that the Democrats controlled Congress in 2007, 2008, and chose to do nothing about solving the problem. Nevertheless, Republicans take the blame for that. They take the blame for the unpopularity in Iraq and Afghanistan. And look, you know, deservedly so on the economy. You know, this is a problem that both parties have contributed to. Both parties have, over the years, paid more and more attention to special interest groups who can buy their way into the political process and less attention to average people. That's just the reality. The good news for the Republican Party, unlike the Democratic Party, is that there's an actual real reform movement brewing within the GOP, and that's basically the Tea Party. And the Tea Party is sort of a street movement, so to speak, but there's all there. It's part of a phase of reform that you see within the Republicans, and it's also you see a lot of reforms on the elite level. You see new politicians coming in. You see challengers to old incumbents. Richard Murdoch in Indiana defeated Dick Lugar in the primary, which was a great thing in my opinion. We got rid of Bob Bennett in Utah and replaced him with Mike Lee. That was a great development. We see reformist governors like Scott Walker, and we see people like Chris Christie and Tom Corbett, and we see Marco Rubio. We see Susana Martinez in New Mexico. In other words, there is a generation of Republicans who are now entering office who I think want to reform. And in fact, if we use the word progressive in a broader sense, a sort of idea of a reformist party, I think the Republicans are more progressive now in the good sense of that word that the Democrats are. The bad news for the Republicans is that none of this new crop is really ripe to run for the presidency right now. Paul Ryan is really too young to run. The one who probably could have run as a reformer was Mitch Daniels, but unfortunately he chose not to. And that left a vacuum to be filled in 2012, and it was filled with demagogues and lightning rods and has-beens. And I won't tell you who I think who was, but you know, I mean, there were in my opinion, there were three serious candidates, or three candidates who had a resume and a political background that were sufficient qualifications to be president. And that was Rick Perry and Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney. And Tim Pawlenty decided basically after he lost the Iowa caucus that he didn't want to do what John McCain did, which is, you know, fly coach. So he quit, right?
Iowa straw poll.
The Iowa straw poll, thank you, yeah. He finished third in the Iowa straw poll. His money dried up, and he didn't want to do... You know, the same thing happened to John McCain in 2008. McCain just soldiered on and, you know, flew coach and did it the hard way. Pawlenty didn't want to do that, so he dropped out. Rick Perry sort of made the same mistake that Fred Thompson made in 2008, which was I can airdrop into this thing without having really prepared much and just on the basis of my charm and you know, sort of Southern accent, I can win the nomination. And he just got schooled in the debates and embarrassed himself. I'd add John Huntsman to the group, at least in theory. Huntsman's problem was that he ran basically as the Republican who was embarrassed to be a Republican. Which is never going to work. So, you know, that basically left Mitt Romney, who, let's be honest, let's be frank, he won the nomination by default. I mean, I think if Mitch Daniels had been in this race, Mitch would be the nominee. And furthermore, I think if Tim Pawlenty had been willing to stick it out, I think Pawlenty might very well be the nominee. Now, that's not to say that we'd be much more enthusiastic about Tim Pawlenty, but it's just to say that Romney basically won the nomination because, in many respects, over the last couple years, the Republican bench has been wiped clean. And like I said, demagogues and has-beens and never was. They basically were Romney's primary candidates. Now, Romney strikes me as an eminently decent man who is completely qualified to be president of the United States. And there are reasons to hope that he could be a good president. But he is nevertheless a terrible fit for the zeitgeist of the moment in his own party, which is sort of being swept up in this Tea Party sort of reformist zeal, and in the country at large. You know, he's not a reformer. He's not a Republican reformer in the same way that, you know, Scott Walker and Chris Christie are. His dad was a moderate Republican from Michigan, and my sense is that he is essentially his father's son. When it comes to the general electorate, look, his wealth is a major problem right now. And this is one of those moments, if you look, for instance, at the 1920s when the American economy was booming, you know, you had, you know, big businessmen like Andrew Mellon were celebrating. Indeed, Mellon was the Secretary of the Treasury for 10 whole years in the 1920s. But after the Depression, the reputation of business plummets, and Franklin Roosevelt is able to demagogue them successfully, win four terms. And Harry Truman basically wins a fifth doing the same thing. That's what a depression or an economic downturn will do, especially when businesses have been so successful in something like TARP, and there's this reputation that the people with money and connections are getting a better deal. For better or worse, Romney gets tied to that. So my opinion, the country is not going to fall in love with him. I think we already know that now. That's not a very controversial prediction. So where does that leave us? Well, I think that we're looking at something similar to 1976. I see a lot of parallels, in fact, between this year and 76. On the one hand, you had Gerald Ford, who was presiding over a mess, who didn't seem particularly well-suited to fix the mess, but who nevertheless wasn't responsible for the mess itself. And he could, you know, point back and say the guys before me were responsible for this, even though, you know, my best idea is a, you know, a button that says win. You know, I mean, that was Ford's best idea on how to deal with inflation. I mean, Ford, people liked Ford, people wanted Ford to be successful, but they didn't blame him for stuff, but it didn't seem like he was, you know, really getting the job done. And then on the other hand, you had Jimmy Carter, who was, I mean, look, Jimmy Carter is the first and only governor or president from the Deep South. He's a peanut farmer from rural Georgia, the Black Belt in Georgia. I mean, we've never had a president like him. He was not a, you know, not somebody that you commonly thought of as presidential material, and turned a lot of people off, frankly. A lot of people looked at Jimmy Carter and said, I'm not buying what he's selling. And the end result was Carter wins by 2% over Gerald Ford. But if you had a third option on the ballot that said none of the above, let's just have a vacant presidency for 4 years, I think it would have won in a landslide. I think most people were probably dissatisfied that year. And I think we see something right now. I think people are deeply, deeply, deeply disappointed in President Obama. I think deep down they think he's done a bad job. Even grading him on the curve for having inherited the mess that he's inherited, I think people are disappointed, and they can point to specific things that they don't like that he did. But at the same time, they're suspicious about Mitt Romney. So what I think we're going to see this year is a very close race where, you know, it's the same old, same old. I mean, this is the same old story we've been talking about since 2000, right? What are the swing states? Well, Virginia's been added as a swing state primarily because Barack Obama, rather than winning, you know, Republicans can win 15% of the black vote in Virginia. They're going to win 5%. So that puts Virginia on the map. Ohio, which has been a perennial swing state, Florida, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Iowa, Colorado, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and Minnesota, and New Mexico are waiting in the wings potentially. Romney's actually heading to Pennsylvania next week, I think, so that race might be opening up. But it's the same old, same old. It's the same states we've been seeing for the last decade. And look, I think what I want to look at Ohio in particular, right? Because when we're talking about one of the earlier points I made was that, you know, both parties have this sort of solid core of support. So they're chasing a very small number of voters. And in some of these states like New Hampshire and Iowa, you have a very large number of independents. But in the other swing states, you really don't. In fact, what you have is a very small number of independents, but the two sides are otherwise evenly divided. And to appreciate this, look, this compares the maps of Ohio in 2004 to Ohio in 2008. And once again, thank you, Dan Rather, for screwing up my color coding. But nevertheless, the Republicans are in blue, the Democrats are in red, and I think that only seven counties flipped. And, you know, amidst all the turmoil over those 4 years, there was only a swing in the margin of less than 7 points within Ohio. And in fact, over the last 20 years, no party's done worse than, I think, 47% of the vote in Ohio, and no party's done better than 53%. Ohio is a swing state because it is evenly divided. The Republicans have solid control over the rural Northwest up here. They have growing control over the rural areas down here. They control the collar counties around Columbus. They control the suburbs of Cincinnati. The Democrats counter with the old sort of industrial manufacturing areas around Youngstown and, of course, Cleveland. And then there's a battle for the Cleveland suburbs. We're going to see the same thing again this year. 2012's map is going to look remarkably similar to the maps in 2004 and 2008. And indeed, you can look at it in terms of regions here. I mean, Obama's margin, right? And this was supposed to be a big landslide for the Democrats, a huge change, a sea change in the way American politics functions. Look at this. He gets pulls 3% of the vote more than Kerry in Metro Cleveland, 7% more in Metro Columbus, 6% more in Metro Toledo, 2% more in Metro Cincinnati. I mean, we're talking about really a game of inches is what's going to be happening here. And not just in Ohio, but also Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Colorado and Nevada. We're really talking about a game of inches. And by the way, that relates to my initial point about being skeptical of the polls, because the sorts of people who are going to shift from this side to this side, or maybe shift back our way, are the sorts of people who pay no attention to politics at this point. They're barely engaged in the political process. They amount to maybe 6% of the electorate. You know, they saw Clinton's speech a couple weeks ago. The pollsters called them up and said, they say, sure, I'm for Obama now. Sure, Clinton convinced me. But then they'll watch the first debate and they like Romney's tie better than Obama's tie. And they'll say, sure, now I'm for Romney. That's how these things go. And that's why those polls historically have been so off in the past. So, conclusion, and what do we say about the future? Well, I think one thing is for sure about the immediate future is that neither side is going to enjoy much of a mandate coming out of this. I mean, we have an enormous number of political problems. I doubt very much if Obama wins, I doubt very much that the Republicans are going to be chastened and agree to tax cuts that they've opposed for generations. Similarly, I doubt very much the Democrats will agree to Medicare reforms. And again, I mean, the problem that we have, the bigger problem we have, is that we are, from a certain perspective, we are now in the 12th year of a secular economic downturn. And nobody knows how to get the economy out of the rut. And moreover, even if there were good ideas, because of all the bad ideas that we've employed and have failed, we now have a $1 trillion-plus budget deficit that constrains policymakers. And historically speaking, as I alluded to at the top of my discussion, we've been in ruts like this before. In the 1880s and the 1890s, it was recession after recession after recession. And unsurprisingly, the country responded by sweeping out the Democrats, then sweeping out the Republicans, then sweeping out the Democrats, then sweeping out the Republicans. And it really only stopped in 1896 when the economy bounced back and the Republicans got to take credit. The same thing happened between basically 1966 and 1982. This sweep out the Democrats, sweep in the Republicans, sweep out the Democrats, sweep in the Republicans, and then finally by 1983 you get economic growth again. And that's probably where I see things going. I mean, the long term beyond this election, as long as the economy remains as weak as it does, and as long as nobody really has any solutions on how to deal with it, none of these other problems are going to be fixed, because it's really the economy that drives the amount of money the Treasury takes in and therefore its ability to deal with problems. But as long as the economy remains weak, you're going to continue to see this swinging back and forth between the two sides. And I think right now what's happened is the country is angry at both sides. So if they could vote for none of the above, that's probably what they would. So on that very gloomy note, I'm happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
Tom Sowell did a study on the growth and disparity of, of course, income levels. Basically, if you look at the census data from 1890 to 1960, that disparity was fairly constant. Didn't close in one. But from 1960 to 2010, the disparity grew enormously. All right, so, you got to do sort of an episodal analysis. You can't do much more than that. You have to figure out what happened in 1960 to change the economic environment or whatever so that this disparity grew. That's one question that I would pose to you. The second is a good friend of mine wrote a very interesting paper, said economic growth, in context of the first question, economic growth drives disparity because it's the relative price elasticity of demand for the various skills that separates the compensation. So if you think about it, in baseball, a left-handed pitcher who throws 95 miles an hour gets paid more than a right-handed pitcher who throws 95 miles an hour because they ain't making any more left-handed pitchers who throw. Okay, so it's the relative elasticity of supply in times of growth that help increase that disparity. And he said the only way you can reduce the disparity is to lower growth. And the last point I would make, and I asked your comment about that, you talk about the dearth of tax revenue. But right now, government spending is 24% of GDP, and it hasn't been that high since the end of the Second World War. So even if you collected your typical 18, 19% of GDP as tax revenues, you still have a very large budget deficit. So where does reality creep in where somebody says, well, we have to do something about that extra 5 percentage points?
Well, look, I think in terms of reality creeping in, I don't think it's on its way.
Yeah, I think so.
I think the corollary I have in mind for the current period is similar to what happened during and after the Civil War, which was basically this, is that during the Civil War, Lincoln wanted to conserve the gold supply, so he printed greenbacks. And he told the bankers in the Northeast, hey, look, you buy these dollars after the war, we'll make sure you get paid back in gold. So the war ends, and the Republic, of course, Lincoln is tragically, no longer on the scene. The war ends, and it's time to pay back the bankers. And, there's two policy choices they can make. The first one is to raise taxes, and which, of course, would sweep them all out of office, which they didn't want to do. So instead, what they decided to do was constrict the money supply. Well, we'll just, stop printing dollars, and then the price of the greenbacks will rise, and therefore you'll effectively be paid back. Well, what ended up happening was it strangled the indebted farmers in the South and the West, and eventually created the populist movement, which brought the country to a crisis point by 1892. I think something similar is happening right now with the Federal Reserve. I think basically what the federal government is going to do is, rather than take any hard choices, they're going to monetize the debt. Monetizing the debt has the advantage of raising taxes on Americans without government actually getting the blame for it. They just see an increase in food and gasoline prices, and then the Democrats can blame the evil oil companies for their profit mongering, I think is probably what's going to happen. Because, look, historically speaking, the way – and this gets back to the way our government was set up. Our government is very, very bad at dealing proactively with problems. Really, historically speaking, our government really only starts to deal with problems once they've hit a crisis point. I think that's probably what's... And the danger in particular is that the United States remains an extremely wealthy country. And it, relative to its counterparts in Western Europe and even in the East, it's still the safest bet in the world. So can the United... there's sort of the old metaphor, kicking the can down the road. Eventually you run out of road. I think there's a lot more road left for the United States to kick the can down and not deal with these problems in a responsible way. And what's going to happen is it's going to be a silent squeeze on the middle class is basically what we're talking about. $3.83 a gallon for gasoline is going to be the cost we pay, which is inefficient. It's socially inefficient. It's economically inefficient, but it is politically efficient for the people who happen to occupy offices in Washington, D.C. right now.
You said two different things that I'd like you to try to reconcile. The exceptionally narrow terrain of undecided or voters up for grabs, swing voters that are deciding current election cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, don't worry about too much yet. Don't worry yet about Obama's lead in virtually every poll,
right?
Because people haven't started to decide.
So right.
Are the undeciders just that narrow terrain? Has everybody else decided? How do you see that?
Well, that's a great question. So he asked, and for those of you who didn't hear, it's a very good question. On the one hand, we have an exceptionally narrow terrain in terms of undecided voters, and on the that's on the one hand. On the other hand, is sort of my admonition not to pay a lot of heed to the polls. And what happens is that. A lot of people who are, like, for instance, the Fox News poll that came out 2 days ago had Obama at 48% and Romney at 43%. And I know a lot of people, I think Laura Ingraham threw up her hands and said, look, we can't talk about poll bias if the Fox News poll is coming in at Romney plus 5. But if you look in the crosstabs of that poll, you'll see that Obama is something at a net 80 plus 85 among Democrats. In other words, he has locked in the Democratic base. Okay, Romney was only at about a net 78 among Republicans. In other words, the remaining Republican base has not yet come home, okay, in that particular poll. And so that, in effect, if you assume that Romney and Obama are going to bring their base home to equal amounts, then it becomes it comes down to basically a race among independent voters where they were tied, right? So the point is that the poll, you know, a lot of this is, you know, so the polls are going to show more than, you know, sometimes are going to show, you know, more than 6% undecided. But my argument is a lot of those people are, you know where they're going to go, right? That if Obama's winning 10, in that Fox News poll, Obama's winning 10% of the Republican vote, he's not going to win that on Election Day. Those people are coming back, and we know enough about history to say they're coming back. So in other words, right now, Romney's at, like I said, Obama, in the RCP average, Obama's at 48.9. Romney, I think, is at 45.7, so it's a 4.2% lead. My contention is that Romney's numbers right now are effectively understated because he has not yet brought home the core vote. And that makes a lot of sense because the Democratic Convention was the last major news event. It disrupted a lot of the core Republican vote from coming home. Romney has struggled in news cycles the last couple weeks. But over the next 3 weeks, I believe two things are going to happen. I believe that Romney's core vote is going to come home, and I think Obama's vote right now is probably overstated a little bit. In other words, true independents right now are just sitting on the Obama camp because of the news environment. I mean, that's sort of the challenge with looking at public opinion polls, is that the undecided voters are voters who are barely engaged can be influenced by the news cycle. So, for instance, what happened in the Gallup poll this week was, is that last week it was at a tie, and now it's at Obama plus six. Well, what happened? What happened was the Obama administration got hit in the gut with the Benghazi story, and they dropped that 47% thing, which, by the way, I suspect was one, at least, if it wasn't the October surprise, it was one of the October surprises. They dropped it early to change the story. People heard that, said, oh, I don't like that, and so the Gallup poll moved. But if I'm right, the Gallup poll will swing back, because that's part of the thing here, is that there's this, you know, these people who are truly undecided, they'll float back and forth, and then they make up their minds at the end. And then there's a small segment of both party coalitions who also float between undecided and the two sides, but they'll end up, by Election Day, they'll end up being with their core group. And so you have to sort of be mindful of swings in the news environment. This, by the way, is why October is so important. And by a month from now, none of us are going to remember today, because a month from now we will. I'm going to make another point, right? I did some math the other night, you know, because like I said, I can't sleep at night because I'm too nervous. So I thought to myself, you know, well, Romney's behind. Well, are they panicking? What are they doing? Well, how can you tell if they're panicking? Well, you look at the states they're visiting. Has he been to North Carolina? If he's going to North Carolina, it's a sign that they're down in North Carolina. Hasn't been to North Carolina. Obama hasn't been to North Carolina either. Now, the polls show Obama up one in North Carolina. So if the Romney campaign thought they were down in North Carolina, don't you think he would have been there in the last month? He hasn't been. Obama has been to Iowa four times in the last month. Now, why would you go to Iowa if you think you have a big lead? Because if you have a big lead, then you're looking at 300 electoral votes, or a padding of about 30 electoral votes more than you actually need. Iowa only has 6 electoral votes. Why are you bothering? Why are you going to Nevada, which he's been to once? And by the way, Nevada's kind of out of the way. You know, most of the swing states are in the South and the Midwest. Fly all the way out to Nevada. He's been to New Hampshire as well. New Hampshire's out of the way as well. Right? When look at campaign finance or the campaign advertisement spending, you know, is Romney panicking? Well, if he was panicking, we'd see him spending a lot more money. We know he's raised the money. He has more money than Obama does. But in fact, if you take the entire constellation of Democratic groups versus the entire constellation of Republican groups over the last 3 weeks of September, for which there's data, basically up through the 22nd. The Democratic constellation has outspent the Republican constellation by about $7 million. The Democrats spent $35 million. The Republicans spent $28 million. And by the way, the same thing happened all through the summer when Obama had a lead. In other words, the Romney team is holding off. And I think what the Romney team is doing, and by the way, I think the Romney's theory of the race is essentially correct, is that he's got 47% locked down, more or less. His floor on Election Day is 47. Obama's floor is 47. That leaves 6% undecided, actually a little less because about a point and a half of them are going to vote for Gary Johnson or otherwise waste their vote. And that it's going to be a battle for basically 5% of the country that pays hardly any attention. And that it's going to come down to October. And what's going to happen in October? We're going to have four debates in October, and the Romney campaign is going to spend easily $100 million. And the entire constellation of Republican interest groups are going to spend $100 million that has not yet been spent is going to happen. And they're going to, and I, the estimate, most recent estimate I heard is that they're going to outspend Obama 5-4 in the month of October. I mean, that's how I see the race going. So the polls, they flutter around, you know, but I think that Romney can count reasonably on 47%. Obama can count on 47%, and the remaining six people, 6% in the middle. It might just be six people. Who knows? Yeah.
I want to ask you about the 6%, the undecided voters. You kind of described them as fundamentally unserious about politics.
Yes. I would go farther and say that they fail to do their civic duties in a Republican form of government such as ours. Nobody calls out this 6% because everybody wants their votes. But I will say, since I'm not running for office, I would say they're terrible citizens and they should be ashamed of themselves. You know, we've been going on for 4 years now, and 5% of the country says that they make up their mind in the weekend before the election. That is shameful. They should be ashamed of themselves. They spend too much time watching Dancing with the Stars and Modern Family and not enough time reading the newspaper.
I think Saturday Night Live did a sketch recently based on that premise. But I want to ask a contrarian question.
Sure.
One could imagine that somebody who doesn't decide until the last minute is actually the opposite of that stereotype, that he's very thoughtful and brooding and doesn't have ideological convictions, perhaps, but really, you know, thinks the decision through in a very serious way. I'm not saying necessarily that's the case. What I'm wondering is, what's the empirical evidence for the stereotype that you put forward here, that I think is the common stereotype?
Right. Well, the idea about ideology, at least the way political scientists think about ideology, is ideology puts restraints on what issue positions you hold. Right. If you are a conservative, you cannot simultaneously be for higher taxes simultaneously be for higher spending and lower taxes. Right. Because you're constrained. And there's a whole series of issues in which to say you're a conservative. It's in other words, ideology is a philosophy. Right. Is what it is, that, you know, you can't be a Marxist and be in favor of, you know, free enterprise. You know, those two things don't work. The non-ideological voters are non-ideological in the sense that their issue positions are not constrained, which is a tip-off that they're not thinking things through, that they actually want, that, you know, they say, do you want to control costs? Yes, absolutely. Do you want to bring the budget deficit down? Absolutely. Well, can we raise your taxes? No. Can we cut social services? No. Can we cut defense spending? No. Okay, well, then what do? In other words, your set of opinions don't make sense. They're internally inconsistent, is typically how I conceive of non-ideological voters. And moreover, these are the sorts of people who think about politics more in terms of personality. You know, these are the people who vote for divided government and then get frustrated when the two sides can't get along. I mean, obviously they can't get along. If they could get along, they'd all be on the same side. You know, I mean, so there's a wealth of very, very, very pessimistic political science literature going back basically to the 1940s with the study of the 1948 presidential election, saying, look, all of our ideals about, you know, citizens exercising their democratic duties is just depressingly off the mark. We fall depressingly far. And the good news is that, you know, I mean, it's sort of a mixed bag, right? Because 94% of the country has at least thought things through to some degree. The problem is that means that the final decision is left to the 6% that haven't. So, you know, I mean, if you're glass half full guy or glass half empty guy, you know, that's about the best I could say. Yeah.
Well, regardless of who wins this election, there is one thing that's fairly certain, and that is that Ryan is the odds-on favorite for the future of the Republican Party. I'd be interested in hearing all of you experts.
You know, I would never be too certain about that.
I'm not certain that he's going to be in a good position.
He will be in a very strong position, but I think he will have some real competition. I think a guy like Bobby Jindal is somebody not to take lightly. A guy like Marco Rubio is somebody not to take lightly. And Chris Christie and Scott Walker and Susana Martinez. I mean, you can imagine all of these people, especially if Romney wins in 8 years. So then we would be talking about not 2016, but we'd be talking about 2020. You know, somebody like Susana Martinez, I think Republicans, you know, in other words, Ryan is probably the most impressive member of what is a very impressive group of people. And in other years, he would be. It's like when I graduated from high school, as the dice fell, you know, my high school graduating class was widely known as the dumbest class. And I was valedictorian of that class, but and I won by a landslide.
That's what they call a humble brag.
Right, a humble brag. No, but if it had been the year before or the year after, I probably wouldn't have, you know, because my class was so dumb, you know. And it's like one of those things. Like, Paul Ryan's an overachiever, but he's going to have to compete with a bunch of overachievers as well, which is a sort of a good problem for Republicans to have. Ted Cruz is another one. And Mike Lee of Utah, there are some serious people, you know, and then there's always the possibility of a dark horse, somebody like Tom Corbett from Pennsylvania, you know. There are a lot of really good Republicans, reasons to be optimistic, at least.
When I asked the question, what I really meant was you to talk about the substance of Ryan, not whether.
Well, look, I think Ryan is, you know, I follow James Madison's maxim, you know, Madison in the Federalist Papers, never, you know, they wrote the Constitution specifically avoiding the great man theory of politics. And I think Ryan tends to be celebrated, over-celebrated. I think he's smart, and I think he gets it, but I think his budget doesn't do enough. And I think that his original budget had some political mistakes in it, and I think that ever since then, I think he's watered it down. I think that the Ryan Wyden plan that he put out most recently was watered down. I think the Romney-Ryan plan is watered down as well. You know, Ryan is making maneuvers in the right direction, but the Ryan budget, I'm just sort of the sort of person to say, look, Paul Ryan is a politician. You know, and he's an ambitious politician, and I think that, unfortunately, in the country right now, you know, Ryan, in other words, Ryan has gotten a lot of political credit by saying, I'm going to talk straight to people about how bad the situation is. But I think that what he does, where I disagree, is gives the impression that we can solve these problems without pain. And I disagree with that. I think that for generations, politicians promised the American people the moon and the stars in the night sky. And they did it on the assumption of 3.5% growth. And they did it when the baby boomers were still in diapers. And now the bills are coming due. And I think that Ryan is implicitly making a promise that we can solve these problems without inflicting pain, and I just disagree with that. I disagree. I think that there is, somebody is going to have to lose. Some class of Americans is going to have to lose. Absent a return to economic growth, somebody's going to have to lose, and we all might lose. Yes?
Okay. First, just on your last statement, they did promise the moon, and they delivered that. So that was one thing government's delivered in the last 40 years.
Good point.
We did go to the vote. Okay. I have two points. One is on the litany of mistakes you think the Obama team made. I want to call attention to one omission, the Dodd-Frank financial services reform, added another layer of uncertainty to the economy, which we're still laboring under and will be for a while longer. Second point is that the evidence against fiscal stimulus predates Obama. As you correctly pointed out, the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress in 07 and 08, and then with the complicity of
the president,
Bush,
yep,
they gave us two fiscal stimuluses that also failed to generate a recovery. So the evidence against fiscal stimulus is pretty potent, and I think it ought not to be forgotten. Now I want to switch gears a little bit to Ohio. I'm a native Ohioan, and I found those statistics you noted about the swings, how these key metropolitan areas swung in 2008 to be pretty intriguing. One, I think, and I was spending a lot of time that year in Ohio for personal reasons, and one thing I was hearing is that Ohio economy then was in miserable shape, maybe as bad as any state in the country, and that was before the financial services collapse. And what was happening is that people were voting against the status quo in massive numbers. So the turnout of anti-incumbent Washington leadership was probably as powerful as it ever has been. So those percentages were magnified by high voter turnout.
Right.
I think now Ohioans are in almost exactly the opposite position. The state of Ohio is one of the best performing economies in the last 2 years, and it's in spite of the policies put in place by the president. It's because of the transformation of the energy industry. And if you want to talk about how the U.S. economy gets out of this mess, we're going to become an energy provider to the world in the next decade. And Ohio could be the leading edge of that.
Right.
Romney can carry that message to Ohio. He will swing those rural counties that are riding the energy boom. He will probably persuade a lot in the metropolitan areas to vote for him, and probably complacency might also undermine Obama's turnout. So I think that Ohio has that element of hope, especially when Romney gets the right.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think you're right about Ohio having had the numbers in Ohio are just what they are. I mean, the economic collapse has been felt to varying degrees in various states and among various demographic groups. It hasn't been evenly distributed. And as somebody from Western Pennsylvania, my wife's a banker, and she knows people deal with wealth management people who have just become millionaires overnight because of the shale gas. The fortunate thing for Romney in this is because you would think that the improvement in the Ohio economy helps Obama, but with the Keystone Pipeline and Obama's anti-coal policies, it's just this, it's like a hanging curve. This is the thing, I am not one to criticize presidential campaigns because they are these huge, they're like corporations essentially. They have more data than we do, they have micro-targeted data, they know who their voters are, they know what they want to hear. And I think I would say if the Romney campaign is smart, and they are smart, they'll target those voters in exactly the way you suggest. And I think, the way you do that, a lot of that stuff can happen under the radar too, by the way. If you are worried about alienating one group versus another group, then you don't go on television where everybody sees the message. You do mailers, but mailers don't get picked up by the national media. Which, by the way, was a big reason in 2004 how Bush managed to transfer 20%. We're talking about this last night. The values voters, a lot of that stuff happened through mailers so as not to alienate culturally moderate women around metropolitan Columbus. That's a way you drive up your vote in, say, Irontown in southern Ohio, which is culturally conservative, without driving down your vote in metropolitan Columbus. So I think that if the Romney campaign is smart, and I know they are, I suspect they'll be doing that. And importantly, again, this gets back to a key point. The metaphor that I have in mind for this election in terms of, I heard a lot of criticism this weekend about Romney, but look, you know, it's like in war. You don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. You know, you don't unload your campaign war chest until voters are engaged. And they're not engaged yet. They're going to engage this month, this upcoming month. Four debates is going to engage the voters, and that is going to be the time you unload your war chest. And that's when you make the kinds of arguments you're making. And I'm sure the Romney campaign knows exactly, is on exactly the same page. I'm sure they know all about the shale gas, you know, and the oil production and coal and so on and so forth.
Points ago. Basically, it's about his, I guess, his spending and who he's targeting and the votes and how, I guess, Obama's, like, things are probably not as certain as they appear to be. I was wondering if Romney is going to win these votes, what is he really waiting for? I mean, because early voting has already started taking effect in, like, well, it's already started.
In Iowa,
and what? Colorado
as well. Some states have started absentee voting.
I mean, but this would be the time. Like,
I think that's right, though. But again, I think that the sorts of people who are voting as early as they are going to be the people who are going to vote anyway at this point as well. You know, I think that the early voting is a cultural thing I'm not really sure has caught on. It's starting in Iowa. And so you start, you know, but now's the time to ramp up because it's just started. You know, that's the other thing. It's just started. And by the way, I haven't seen the advertising data for this last week. So they might have already started. I mean, I just had there's a 1 week lag on the advertisements, right? So it might have just it might be starting now. But you know, my guess is the people who are voting now are people who are already locked in as partisans, because it requires a certain level of civic engagement to know that early voting has begun, which means you're civically engaged, which means you probably are an ideologue and probably made up your mind months ago, would be my guess. Sure, of course.
Back to the 47.6% thing.
Right.
I guess the cynical kind of 6% people who are not the best citizens, not necessarily engaged. I wonder, would that not just also kind of transcend to the 47% on either side? I mean, not, there are people who are probably voting for Democrats or for Republicans who don't really know their policies inside and out.
They're absolutely,
because that's like the environment which they're
absolutely. You know, political scientists historically, you know, the Michigan School in the 1960s acknowledged that, and they sort of said that. Certain people's political opinions are bound by various things. And the most sophisticated form of being bound was, ideology. Another form of being bound was interest group affiliation, ethnic group affiliation, and then just pure partisanship. What we're talking about here are people who are unbound, right? Who have no, like, because even people who are just non-ideological Republicans still have a level of sophistication that these voters lack. I mean, in other words, put another way, it's about how your political thinking is organized, right? Is it organized on an ideological level, on a partisan level, on an interest group level? This 6% are people whose political thinking is basically disorganized. There's no organization to it, is how I would categorize them. Yeah.
I have a question about the participation. Turnout,
right.
Democrats.
Okay.
I know a lot of Democrats who are pretty vigorous in their opinions, pretty committed ideologically, but who are, in my estimation, in this coming election, very lukewarm.
Right.
Very lukewarm. And I was just wondering how, you know, your impression of that phenomenon.
Well, look, there's a lot of myth that was created in the 2008 presidential election. A lot of it was created by the Obama campaign purposefully. The Obama campaign, the permanent Obama campaign, has done a very good job of spinning otherwise neutral political analysts, supplying them with data, supplying them with all sorts of things. There's a mythology that was created, right? And the mythology was more Democrats than ever. False. False. 39% of the electorate in 2008 was Democratic. The long-run quarter-century average has been between 37% and 39%. So this is simply false to say that more Democrats than ever turned out. What happened was there was a drop-off in the Republican vote from 37% to 32%. But there was also a corresponding increase in the independent vote. The other thing that happened that was very interesting as well is that in the 2006 congressional midterms, the Democrats and Republicans were basically even in their partisan identification. Democrats turned out at 38%, Republicans at 36%. But the Democrats won that midterm because they won the independent vote by 20 points. In 2008, the Democrats were at 39%, the Republicans at 32%, but Obama only won the independent vote by 8 points. My suspicion about what really happened in 2008 was that overall Obama accomplished a very impressive increase in the black vote that went from 11% to 13%, which drove most of the increase in non-white vote in 2008. But it corresponded with a decline in the white Democratic vote, so that net-net, it was only basically, you were still within the historical ranges. And what meanwhile happened on the Republican side was that John McCain was a terrible nominee, the economy was in collapse, and George W. Bush's job approval was at 20%. So a lot of marginal Republicans told the exit pollsters that they were independents, but in fact voted Republican. I don't know how else to explain why congressional Democrats won the independent vote in 2006 by 20 points, but Obama only won it in 2008 by 8 points. So I think there's a lot of mythology, because one of the issues here is that, again, this gets back to the idea, the exit polls say, okay, are you a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent? Roughly speaking, the country breaks out 33-33-33. But that... a lot of pollsters ask a follow-up question of the independents. Do you lean one way or the other? And then when you see that, it actually turns out to be 45-45-10, with the 10 being the pure independents. See, that's the thing that we didn't see in 2008, because the exit polls don't actually ask independents which way they lean. Okay? So there's a lot of confusion about partisan identification. And in particular, the Obama campaign... again, and by that I mean the permanent Obama campaign that has endured since 2007, has utilized that confusion to convince people, and potentially pollsters as well, that there's been a fundamental sea change in American party identification that I don't think has actually happened. Or, at the very least, the jury is most certainly still out on that.
What do you think about the argument that the evidence that they did against the incumbent?
Well, look, they break again. Historically speaking, again, it depends on when you use the word break, right? Use the word break against the incumbent. The question is when. Historically speaking, challengers tend to improve their margins in the Gallup poll by an average of 4 points between now and Election Day. So the October deciders often, but not always, the October deciders will break towards the challenger. The very late deciders, I mean, what happened in 2008 was Obama had a narrow lead of people who made up their minds before September. He won September overwhelmingly. He won October overwhelmingly. And then the final late deciders were basically a coin flip. They split 50-50. I mean, they might, for all I know, they might have literally flipped a coin, some of those people. I'm sure somebody did. Somebody voted having flipped a coin. But the exit poll suggested that about 4% of the country flipped a coin on the weekend before. So that's the thing, is that my expectation, and again, it's not always the case, though, because you look at a year like 1976, Gerald Ford was down 11 points, and he ends up surging back. He's the incumbent, right? You look at 1968, Hubert Humphrey was down 15 points, and he ends up surging back. So if you just take a naive average of incumbent versus challenger, you'll see that the movement isn't always impressive. But you can see how in a lot of respects how Ford and and Humphrey are similar to Romney this year, and that both of them had to deal with very negative media environments up to that point. But because October focused voter decision-making down with the ads and then in 76 with the debates, that you can sort of see how Romney has this potential here to focus the electorate. By the way, the same thing happened with George H.W. Bush in 92. You know, Clinton had dropped out, or excuse me, Perot dropped out right on the eve of the Democratic convention. And basically endorsed Clinton, and Clinton jumps from being like at 25% in the polls to 50%. Then Perot jumps back in, and all through October you see Clinton and Bush coming back down to basically a tie as the Perot vote comes back online. And Clinton only won that thing in the last week or so of the election because of it. But the polls were off because of the quirkiness of Perot that year. So, you know, I mean, that the point is that and my point in sort of pointing out the difference between September and October polls is not to say, look, you know, it's going to swing Romney's way. It's just to say, look, you know, September polls stink. You know, they were on the mark in 1984, but they were on the mark in 1972. They were on the mark in 1988, but they were off in 68, 76, 80, 96, 92, 2000, 2004, and 2012. So, you know, I'm not going to put a lot of stock in those polls right now.
Okay. Thank you.